The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
I'm Anna Marie Cox, and my day job is hosting a podcast over at Crooked Media called With Friends Like These.
And hi, my name is Daniel Dresner, and my day job is being a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University and writing a column for The Washington Post.
And we usually moonlight hosting The Churn, a podcast about The Expanse. But this is not that.
No, we are, let's face it, suddenly in this weird moment when sci-fi and horror tropes are colliding with our actual reality. And so we thought it would be useful to have a podcast that tries to explain when fiction can help us understand real life and also when it can't. So we'll be looking at different genres and also we'll be looking at particularly standout pieces of fiction from the likes of Chuck Wendig and Max Brooks.
Basically, welcome to The Churn, Pandemic Edition. I should warn you, though, we are not starting with a work of fiction. We are starting with a textbook.
Don't click away.
It's okay. Dan wrote the textbook.
Which means it's awesome. But the textbook's name is Theories of International Politics and Zombies.
And it's a real life textbook. Like, people have used it in classes and whatnot.
Many, many students have had to buy this book, and I will apologize to all of them for the fact that they have had to buy it. But yes, in the since it came out in 2011, it's been successful beyond my wildest dreams in terms of the fact that it's used. And I wrote it, to be fair, because it does actually talk about very real theories of international politics. And I sort of figured that your average 18-year-old does not know a lot about international relations theory, but they do know a lot about zombies. And so this was a way in which they could sort of ease them into the genre.
So we should warn people that they might learn something.
It is entirely probable that they will learn something, because sneaky professor that I am, I have tucked large amounts of knowledge into this book, and it will appear on occasion in this podcast.
And the things that they will learn have to do with paradigms of international relations theory, which are the systemic things, the paradigms. And that's what we're going to talk about in this episode, are paradigms. We have another episode coming up that'll deal more with domestic politics. Okay.
Yeah. The paradigms that are most widely talked about in international relations, unlike, let's say, physics or chemistry or biology, does not have one single theory that explains everything. There's a lot of contested stuff out there. So there are different paradigms that attempt to explain the way the world works. And the paradigms that are the most well-known are the ones that are so-called systemic, meaning it doesn't start with individuals, it doesn't start with states, it starts with the entire international system and focuses on key characteristics of that system and tries to explain, therefore, what will happen. And I should also stress that, you know, being a good social scientist, that, you know, when I started writing this book asked the very, very important question of what different theories would predict would happen if the dead started rising from the grave. You know, good social scientists, of course, always want to start by relying on good data. So I thought about, well, maybe we could use experimental methods. But experimental methods in this particular case are problematic for a variety of reasons, as anyone familiar with the zombie genre should know. Not to mention, you know, universities have these things called human subjects committees that would probably make it problematic.
Oh, but I want to point that out. You probably could get some 18-year-olds to volunteer if the committee, like, let you. But you didn't.
Right, but the committee will not let us, unfortunately. Once again, you know, university bureaucracy gets in the way. You know, you could, if without experimental evidence, maybe you would want to rely on statistical data, you know, large examples of zombie outbreaks. But of course, the man will not give us this data. You know, we have a few bits and pieces of information from the federal government, including the official government plan for how to deal with a zombie pandemic, which I can talk about later. But by and large, they're not giving us that. So in the end, what I chose to do was rely on these theories and then test these theories on the zombie canon, the sort of classic works from film and fiction, from George Romero's Night of the Living Dead on, to see whether or not what they say would happen in a zombie apocalypse is actually consistent with what these theories would say.
Shall we dive into these theories?
Let's dive in indeed. We're going to start with the oldest theory of international politics, which is commonly referred to as realism. So realism has a very simple, elegant theory that many people do not like because it implies very nasty things about the world. But essentially, realists start by pointing out that we fundamentally live in a world defined by anarchy. And anarchy here does not necessarily mean chaos. It doesn't necessarily mean, you know, disorder. Anarchy just means that there is no central government out there. There is no overarching hierarchical figure that tells everyone what they're supposed to do in the world.
Professor Dresner, I have a question.
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead, Anna.
Which is it what you're saying that we live in a world of anarchy even if we don't call it that? Like,
correct.
There can be a situation where somebody says they're running things, but actually what really is happening in reality, realpolitik, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, very
is
good.
Is that we actually are in a state of anarchy.
That is correct. Another way to think about it is that nominally, at least, you would think, you know, there's the United Nations, right?
Right.
The United
that's
Nations
what I,
Security
yeah.
Council, you know, could in theory order countries to do certain things. In actual point of fact, the very fact that five great powers have a veto power within the UN Security Council, and the fact that very often the UN Security Council cannot even get its act together to tell people what to do, which is, by the way, happened during this coronavirus outbreak, is testament to the fact that we live in this world of anarchy, that there is no single overarching power out there. So realism says that if we live in an anarchic world, you know, sort of Hobbes's, you know, war of all against you all, that if it's a dog eat dog or man eat man kind of world out there, essentially, what should states who are the primary actors in realism care about? And realists say that states basically have to care about their survival, their security, and their sovereignty. So their survival is most important. In an anarchic world, it is possible for one country to invade another and no one else is necessarily going to stop it. It is possible for great powers to bully smaller, weaker states. It is also possible for great powers to go to war with each other. And so states can die and disappear. We've seen this in history. You know, anyone who's Polish is fully aware of the way in which Poland was simply gobbled up during the 15th and 16th centuries. If you are living in Ukraine right now, you are fully aware that you are living next to a great power that does not necessarily respect your ability to survive. And so states have to be wary about that. And even if they know they're going to survive, they want to be concerned about their security. They want to make sure that they can guard against threats from the outside world. And they also care about their sovereignty, which is states don't like being told by other states and by international organizations what to do. They want to have exclusive domain over how their citizens should act and behave. And so they will be very reluctant, according to realists, to give up or surrender that sovereignty.
Can we get to the zombies now, Dan? Dan, can
yes,
we get to the zombies?
Yes. Okay. Let's get to the zombies. So
can I make a guess?
Yeah, go ahead.
About this. It's everyone out for themselves, right? Like mm-hmm. That's anarchy.
Exactly.
So
correct.
You might have a situation which might sound familiar, which every government kind of just does its own thing to deal with the crisis, some more successfully than others. Like, let's say Sweden does nothing and zombies just overrun it. And then mm-hmm. other countries do. Some countries decide to let, you know, develop herd immunity to zombies. I don't know if that exists, but it's anarchy. Like, it's just
right.
Everyone just does whatever.
It's not just anarchy. Basically, states have to engage in what's called self-help. They can only count on themselves. And any kind of cooperation among different actors will be at best ephemeral and transitory and most likely will not last at all. And you see this throughout, you know, it's the dominant way of thinking within the zombie canon. Which is to say, sort of most zombie movies are very skeptical about the ability of people to cooperate when faced with a common threat posed by the undead. And this goes all the way back to George Romero's sort of classic Night of the Living Dead. And I think in some ways there's a clip in there that highlights the way in which realists think about the world. And there's a scene in which, you know, the movie largely consists of seven people trapped in a farmhouse surrounded by an ever increasing horde of the living dead. And they wind up beginning to disagree about the best way to go about things. And they actually wind up creating separate levels of sovereignty.
Gotta fix these boards. You're crazy. Those things are going to be in every window and door in this place. We've got to get down into the cellar.
Go down in that damn cellar. Get out of here!
I'm taking the girl with me.
You leave her here. Keep your hands off her. And everything else that's up here, too. Because if I stay up here, I'm fighting for everything up here. And the radio and the food is part of what I'm fighting for. Now, if you're going down the cellar, get.
The man's insane. He's insane. We've got to have food down there. We've got a right.
This is your house.
We've got a right.
You going down there with him?
Well,
yes or no, this is your last chance. No beating around the bush.
Listen, I got a kid down there. She can't possibly, I couldn't bring her up here. She can't possibly take all the racket and those things smashing through the windows.
Well, you're her father. If you're stupid enough to go die in that trap, that's your business. However, I am not stupid enough to follow you. It is tough for the kid that old man is so stupid. Now, you get the hell down in the cellar. You can be the boss down there. I'm boss up here.
You bastards!
So as you can see, you know, the actors are disagreeing. There's scarce resources, food, information. They're going to argue about this. They're going to try to be their own boss. They don't want to be controlled by anyone else. And this is why, among other things, Night of the Living Dead doesn't end terribly well, because any of this farm, you know, the members of this farmhouse efforts of cooperation fail miserably. And in the end, they all die.
So like you said, this seems to be the dominant paradigm in the zombie canon. And I am thinking of the most popular piece of zombie canon there is, at least right now, which is The Walking Dead.
Yes, I was very fortunate because this book came out roughly around the time that The Walking Dead premiered. And, you know, the first couple seasons of The Walking Dead, there are really two different ways of thinking about the world. There's Rick, who at the time believes that it's possible to still live in a humane way, even in a world dominated by walkers. And then there's his rival, Shane, who thinks, no, it's a complete Hobbesian world out there and you can't trust anyone. And admittedly, by the third season, Rick has killed Shane. So you would think that Rick wins. And yet, in some ways, the evolution of The Walking Dead is that Shane was right all along, that no one
spoilers
can trust
anyone for Walking
else.
Dead. Jeez, Dan.
I know. I'm sorry. Although, on the other hand, in 2020, if you're, you know, if you haven't watched it yet, then, you know, that's on you.
But spoilers for every zombie movie, like realism seems to be the description of every zombie movie that is premised upon, you know, we're the real monsters.
Basically, and that's the thing to realize about the zombie genre more generally is that what's interesting about most zombie films or zombie fiction is not the living dead.
Right.
It's the human beings. It's how do humans react to this? And yeah, although there are exceptions, which we'll get to, the overwhelming dominant outcome in most zombie films and zombie fiction is humans are awful. They can't cooperate. They're selfish. And that leads to a tragedy in which the zombies eventually outrun them all or overrun them all.
Okay. And that is true. That is how most zombie movies and books end. But there are other options.
So, yes. And this means we turn to the second paradigm of international relations, and that's called the liberal theory of international politics. And liberals have a lot of the same assumptions as realists. Liberals assume that we also live in a world defined by anarchy. They also assume that states are the most important actors. The difference is that liberals do not believe that anarchy automatically leads to a lack of cooperation, that anarchy automatically leads to a war of all against all. Liberals believe it is possible to cooperate even in a world in which there is no overarching actor.
Now, Dan, this sounds a little bit like what the progressive stance would be in the United States. But when you say liberal here, I remember enough from college, I think, that you don't mean liberal by the way we define it in the United States.
That is correct. While it is probably true that most American liberals are also, you know, implicitly have liberal theories of international politics, the two do not match up. Among other things, liberals in terms of international relations don't really talk as much about what domestic policy should look like. Think of it as small L liberal, like, okay. You know, in that sense. So what liberals would argue is that the way to make the world a more cooperative place is to essentially rely on three things. The first is to promote the use of international organizations, global governance structures that would help states be able to cooperate and also enforce any kind of cooperation in case a state is tempted to defect. The second thing that liberals would want to do is have more economic interdependence. The logic being that if the more interdependent states are, the less likely they're going to defect from cooperation. And then finally, liberals are also fans of democracy. Liberals believe in something
Woo,
called
democracy. Go, yay! Right. All right.
They believe in the democratic peace, and the democratic peace is generally an argument that says that two democracies are significantly less likely to go to war with each other than other dyads, other pairs, either a democracy and a non-democracy or two autocracies. And so liberals believe that if you create this, you know, world in which you have democracies and lots of trade and lots of global governance structures, you will have, you know, something that is anarchic, but at the same time is much more peaceful.
And you can have something work out. Like there is a happy ending if you believe right. in this scenario, which are few and far between in the zombie canon.
Correct. And Immanuel Kant actually called this the perpetual peace in the end. So, yes.
And I'm trying to think of an example. Would World War Z be an example of this?
No, I mean, in theory, yes, I suppose. Let me just wait. The movie, yes. The book is a little more complicated than that.
Right.
Actually, the book is a lot more complicated than the movie, but that's
right.
A separate
Well, then let's make in the Brad Pitt version of World War Z.
There is a way in which, I mean, let's put it this way. Brad Pitt's character, Jerry Lane, in that movie is absolutely a liberal.
Yes.
And I know this, by the way, because Brad Pitt told me this.
Oh, my goodness. Well, OK, yes. Well, now you can't just drop that in. Like, did Brad Pitt like show an interest in your book or something?
Brad
like,
Pitt
what?
Read my book, apparently.
Oh, yes. Wow.
So I know that when this wasn't for me, but when they were making World War Z, apparently Brad and was with Angelina at the time, went to the Council on Foreign Relations to actually try to get some expert technical advice about this. And the person there gave them my book. And so Brad apparently read the book and said, yeah, I'm a liberal. You know, the liberal theory is the one I like. So,
all right. Well, I was just guessing, but I'm glad that I have the Brad Pitt stamp of approval, as apparently you do as well.
Yes. So liberalism offers it's a tricky theory when it comes to the zombie apocalypse, because liberals have to acknowledge that the very policies they want to pursue also make it very, very likely that the zombie pandemic will go global. It is, in fact, you know, a world of more open borders, of course, makes it easier for the living dead to cross borders. And because we live in a world in which, in theory, anyone can get from point A to point B in, let's say, 36 hours, it is very easy to envisage a world in which the zombies manage to cross borders effortlessly. And so this becomes problematic, that in some ways it becomes a global problem more quickly. On the other hand, liberals also believe that it is possible for actors to cooperate for. And by the way, when I say actors, as Anna asked me, I do not mean actors like Brad Pitt. I mean actors as in states or non-governmental organizations or international organizations.
I'm looking forward to the day that we talk enough that I start using actors that way and they'll confuse like other people. It will just pass on the confusion as though it were a contagion.
Right.
So anyway, I like this liberal paradigm, and I really want to believe that there's examples to learn from.
Well, I think the strongest within the zombie canon, the best example of the liberal theory is actually the rom-zom-com. is the romantic zombie comedy. And the best example of this is Shaun of the Dead, you know, which is really the first example of this and really just a great movie in its own right. But there's an interesting scene in Shaun of the Dead that actually parallels the scene we talked about before in Night of the Living Dead, where, again, you've got six people. They're trapped. This time they're trapped in a bar rather than a farmhouse. So automatically, you know, it's a slightly better situation. But in contrast to the bickering and division that you see in Night of the Living Dead, the outcome in Shaun of the Dead is relatively different.
Okay, has anyone fired a gun before?
Oh, yeah.
Apart from Ed.
I'm a pacifist.
Apart from David and Ed.
Sorry, what was Ed's experience?
He shot his sister in the leg with an air rifle.
I think you should do it.
I think we should all do it.
Who can five people operate one gun?
None of us have any real experience, okay? Now, we've only got 29 bullets. Call them shells. We've only got 29 shells. We really need to work together on this. I need someone to help me reload, everyone else to look out. I will fire. As Bertrand Russell once said, the only thing that will redeem mankind is cooperation. I think we can all appreciate the relevance of that now.
in the rom-com genre, you know, the idea is that, yes, zombies pose a serious threat. And the liberal theory would have to acknowledge that the zombie pandemic might be a real problem. On the other hand, it would presume that you would see the creation of international structures, of international alliances, and that essentially the key actors in the world, key states in the world, would realize that they have to hang together in the face of the undead, or they will be eaten separately.
So I do have, I guess, a real life question about this. Is this theory ever been proven to be correct? Because world history suggests we're not so good at that, that it is just a theory.
No, I mean, there are ways in which it's been proven correct. The idea of the democratic peace is a real one.
OK,
that's been proven to be correct. Okay. And also there is a fairly robust evidence that states that are more economically interdependent do not go to war with each other.
And so in theory, these are the states I want to emphasize this. So these are the states that would survive a zombie horde. The states that are interconnected and democratic would be the most prepared to deal with the undead.
The idea, yes, the idea is also that they would band together to deal with the undead.
Right, presumably.
That they would have stronger resources, you know, more resources they could throw at the problem. They would also presumably learn from each other, that you would see the sort of adoption of best practices and what have you.
That happens in World War Z, but the book, right? Like, isn't there like...
Yes.
Yeah.
That is shot through in World War Z, the book, which is one of the reasons why the book is so great. But you're right that the liberal theory is more complicated because it also has to acknowledge that globalization facilitates the spread of the undead. And mm-hmm. so in some ways, again, thinking to the real world, there is no denying that the coronavirus spread more quickly precisely because people were able to cross borders. And that is why you now see so many travel restrictions. Although it should be pointed out that if you would even impose those travel restrictions at the very outset, it's not clear they would have worked.
Well, this week may be able to just digress very quickly here to the fast and slow zombies, because I was thinking about the coronavirus in the context of the fast and slow zombies, and it's definitely a slow zombie, right?
That's correct. So yes. So I have a chapter in the book that says, you know, that deals with this very, very important controversy within the zombie studies community of fast zombies versus slow zombies.
And it's especially relevant to the liberal paradigm. That's why we're right. digressing here a little bit. But yes, please.
Exactly.
Essentially,
the issue is that, you know, would you see a different kind of spread if you were dealing with fast zombies as opposed to slow zombies? And the answer I would offer is no. Because while fast zombies would presumably, you know, cause an immediate reaction, because they spread so quickly, they are literally fast, it is likely that they would overrun the ability of states to stop the living dead from crossing borders, and so there would be a global problem. On the other hand, the problem with slow zombies is that usually in slow zombies, the gestation period is also slow. So in other words, if you get bit by a zombie, it might take a whole day or it might take 2 days before you die and then turn into a zombie. And again, because zombies are slow, it is likely that there would not necessarily be a perception of really seriously acute threat. And so the issue is that much like the coronavirus, states would be slow to act, to take steps to try to engage in contact tracing or to quarantine those who are feared.
Well, there would be asymptomatic carriers.
Exactly.
That's the problem. Yeah.
People who've been bitten, you know, somewhere where you don't automatically see them. And so as a result, it is also likely that the zombie threat would go global. It would take a longer time because they're slower zombies. But there is no denying that this would be it would also go global. Indeed, my favorite thing that I wrote in the book, which is something the political scientists tend to do a lot, which is a 2x2 chart. and the 2x2 chart shows that it doesn't matter if the zombies are fast or slow or if their origins are biological or supernatural.
Little inside joke for those political scientists on the pod.
Yes. The outcome is the same. They go global. I have to admit. So when I used to give this talk, that was one of those slides I would show where, like, there were slides I would show where, you know, everyone in the audience laughed. They immediately understood what I was saying. And then there were slides where you had to be in grad school to get the joke.
Well, now people who have listened to this podcast, at least if they ever see a 2x2 slide, will be able to, like, have some knowledge of what the joke that we had just now is. Oh, okay, sorry.
Exactly.
So this is a very delayed joke for everybody. I actually think this discussion of different kinds of zombies leads us pretty smoothly into our next paradigm, which is social constructivism, right?
That is correct. So the next paradigm of social constructivism makes rather different assumptions than either the realist or liberal paradigm. Both of those paradigms tend to focus much more on sort of material wants and needs of the actors. Social constructivists believe that reality is socially constructed. Now, that doesn't mean that therefore they can pretend like, you know, zombies don't exist or you know, just wish away zombies. That's not how it works. But what it does mean is that what primarily constrains these actors in a constructivist world are norms. And what
I remember, you know, those. Words,
yes. You know, norms like it's bad to compare people to Nazis. It's bad to say good things about Nazis.
It's,
you know,
bad to have a rambling 3-hour press conference in which you basically just air your grievances rather than, oh, I don't know, deal with the zombie horde. But norms, which we all fondly remember. Yes. Go ahead.
Right. And the other thing that matters is the thing that presumably drives actors in this world is a sense of identity. Actors want to know who they are, and they often define their identity as opposed to the other, as opposed to who they think of as the enemy or so forth. And so what actors in constructivism want to do is try to navigate a reality that means that they're comfortable in their identity, that they are promoting norms that they believe to be true, and that those norms are widely accepted across international society.
So I can't help but think of where we are now in relation to social constructivism, because I feel like there's sort of an identity process happening, at least in America, around how I behave as a citizen. Like, what does it mean to be a good citizen? I mean, we could transport that into zombie land as like, am I being a good citizen to do what I can to stop the spread of zombies? Or am I being a good citizen if I just go along in my daily life and pretend the zombies don't exist, right? Like, is that sort of like...
Well, it's even worse. I mean, to get a little scarier, part of the other issue is that in terms of your identity, do you see yourself as an American, and who else do you see as Americans in this world? And so, yeah, there's a lot of identity insecurity going on in a world of the living dead, and or a world of the pandemic, which is why I think you're seeing some of the reactions you're seeing, particularly in the United States.
Yeah, because it has to do with how I identify will govern the ways that I behave in relations to whatever, like relation to zombies or pandemic or whatever.
Right. And so the constructivist theory has some interesting suggestions for how you would cope with the zombie pandemic, let's just say. So what it suggests is that the way to deal with zombies, according to social constructivism, is to make them adhere to human norms. That if you can somehow socially pressure zombies into recognizing that eating people is bad, that is a taboo that you should not embrace, that instead there are other ways to channel your desire for flesh. You know, maybe you can eat cows or you know, other forms of animals, you know, and we've seen in the zombie canon, there are examples of zombies who are at least partially socialized into human behaviors. In Romero's Day of the Dead, there's a character named Bub who starts acting a little human-like. There are movies like Fido in which zombies are turned into undead labor, actually. So the idea is that in theory, if you could actually get the zombies to embrace powerful human norms, you would sort of socially construct your way out of the problem, that they would act much like, you know, humans, and therefore that would be fine. There's just one slight problem with this model, there's two. The first is that there's no guarantee that the zombies would feel in any way constrained by these norms. They're dead. They're kind of unthinking in that way. And so, you know, that they might not go for it. And this leads to the second problem, which is if you have a sufficiently large critical mass of zombies, it might be that the zombie norms wind up prevailing as opposed to the human norms. Ooh. And so if you're operating in a world in which there are an awful lot of zombies out there, even the remaining humans might wind up adopting particular zombie tropes. And we see this in Zombieland because, among other things, there's a scene where a very special guest star, and I'm not going to ruin the spoiler here, seems to emerge as a zombie. And it turns out that there's something else going on.
Bill Murray, you're a zombie?
You're not a zombie. You're talking. You're okay.
The hell I am.
I'm sorry.
I didn't know that it was you, you.
Are you, what's with the getup?
Oh, I do it to blend in. You know, zombies don't mess with other zombies. A buddy of mine, makeup guy, showed me how to do this. Cornstarch, you know, some berries, a little licorice for the ladies. It suits my lifestyle. You know, I like to get out and do stuff. Just played 9 holes over Riviera. Just walked on. Nobody there.
God damn it, Bill fucking Murray!
The issue becomes, in a constructivist world, which norms wind up dominating? Will it be the human norms that actually constrain zombie behavior? Or will it be the zombie norms that wind up being seen as more appealing to humans? And while you might think that eating human flesh is gross if you're human, there are other zombie norms that are kind of appealing. You know, zombies don't discriminate. They will eat anyone, regardless of race, gender, you know, or sexual orientation. You know, zombies are also...
And once you become a zombie, it's an incredibly egalitarian society.
Right. Zombies don't turn on each other. Zombies don't, you know, attack each other. It's incredibly egalitarian, as you said. And also, they're very eco-friendly, you know. They really are. They don't drive. They don't, you know, use airplanes. They walk everywhere, and they only eat local organically grown produce. And so the question becomes, you know, if you have like a vanguard, you know, element of human culture that decides they want to embrace the zombies, you know, it might be that as more humans decide that it's hip to be zombie, you could then see one of these tipping points where that becomes the norm that's embraced. And I do have that.
Or if zombies could make zombie living look appealing enough, right? Like, I guess that doesn't really fit social constructivism, but I'm thinking that Thriller, you know, is a very good example of like why you might want to become a zombie, because apparently it imbues you with the ability to dance like Michael Jackson.
I mean, if you want the funk, then yeah, let's face it. I mean, you know, for those of us who grew up with that video, you know, suddenly the evil of the Thriller looks awfully tempting, is all I'm saying.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
All right, so those are the major paradigms. I want to figure out how to help us understand what's happening now using those.
Right.
But I want to reiterate, this is just like at the high level, right? Like all these paradigms won't necessarily help us understand what's happening like on the ground or domestically.
That's correct. I mean, again, these theories are almost entirely systemic. They don't have anything, all that much of substance to say about what's happening within states. It's primarily, are you seeing significant amounts of international cooperation? Are you not? How are these states coping with other states? What kind of behavior are you seeing at that sort of macroscopic level? You know, are international organizations contributing, or are they part of the problem? You name it.
And I guess I also want to point out that you can think about the zombie horde and a pandemic kind of in the same way. There is the sort of slow zombie metaphor, right?
That's correct,
like,
yes.
Where we have the asymptomatic carriers.
Right.
And we are definitely seeing the way that it crosses borders.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually was just trying to think about, you know, it'd be interesting to think about the economics of a zombie horde, because I'm thinking here, I mean, I guess any kind of apocalyptic disaster would cause huge economic
yes, that's a safe assumption to make. Yeah.
But, you know, in a zombie pandemic, you would also probably have left people staying indoors, I'm thinking.
Also true.
Stop the spread. I can see a stop the spread campaign mm-hmm. in a zombie pandemic.
Actually, so...
But let's talk about our pandemic, if you want.
Yes. So there are ways in which there are strong parallels to some of the theories that we've talked about, some on the negative side, some of them on the more encouraging side. On the negative side, there is no denying that realism seems to explain a fair amount of the international response to this pandemic, which is it would be safe to say that international cooperation in response to COVID-19 has been lacking, has been wanting.
It is to laugh.
Yeah. So
yeah, this is an every state for itself. Like yeah. No one seems to be. There is a theoretical best practices, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Although interestingly enough, the best practices aren't coming from the great powers, which is what realism would have predicted. The best practices are coming from small states. You know, the states that have handled this best are places like New Zealand or Iceland or, you know, maybe a little larger, but South Korea or Singapore. None of the great powers, whether you're talking about China or the United States or Russia or India or the European Union, if you think of the European Union together, you know, collectively as a great power, none of them have handled this well. It is impressive, actually.
And because I've seen your talk on this, I actually know that the fact that New Zealand handled this pandemic pretty well is something that you kind of wargamed for yourself.
When I was giving the talk about the book, I got asked constantly, what is your plan? You know, what is your own personal plan for the zombies? And of course, I always felt weird when asked that question, because it's like, if I had that plan, like, I'm going to tell you all that. But that said, my plan, as I thought about it, was that I would go to New Zealand, because New Zealand is geographically remote. So anything that affects anywhere else should probably, you know, come there late, on the late side. If you've ever been to New Zealand, you know that everything grows there. It's a remarkably fertile land. So, you know, things like food, which is important, you know, would not be in short supply there.
If you're not a zombie, also, you need food that is grown and not, you know, born.
Right. It's also very mountainous. And zombies don't climb very well, based on what I've seen in the literature. So I always thought that would be useful. And of course, the wines are excellent. So, you know, you weren't going to go wrong. And, you know, now in the wake of seeing how they've responded to COVID-19, I can add good governance to that list, because they've handled this remarkably well, far better than most other countries.
And actually, so I was thinking, you know, what can we learn from zombies to this? But if you do another revived edition of this book, Dan, I wonder if you could use some of the reactions that states have had to the pandemic to sharpen some of your zombie theories.
So first, let me apologize yet again for the puns that are just...
No one read it. If you don't like puns, don't read the book.
Full disclosure, I am not a fan of puns. But as I was writing this book, it was impossible to avoid the puns. They're just all over the place. I'm sorry about that. But yes, if I write a resurrected edition of this book, there is no denying, and I actually thinking about doing it now, because as you say, the government responses across the board have been very interesting to analyze. It's one of these things where, as a political scientist, I'm fascinated. As an American, I'm horrified, but as a political scientist, I'm fascinated.
But it does look like I want to get into this. So if we do zombies keying off of how people have reacted or how states have reacted to the pandemic, definitely New Zealand, definitely Iceland, definitely South Korea. So we're looking at states that are not that populous, because that seems to be a factor, right?
Yeah.
Wealthy.
Yes.
And I would say also have kind of a rule-based sort of culture.
Right. No, there's a strong adherence to the rule of law, strong trust in institutions. That matters a great deal, clearly. And so that's not nothing. So as it turns out, all of the things that make, you know, societies reasonably well-run during normal times, it turns out actually makes them reasonably well-run during a pandemic. And so in that sense, it's been consistent. I mean, realism explains an awful lot here. There's no way to say it any other way. The fact that the cooperation with the World Health Organization is broken down, that as we're talking about this, the Trump administration has suspended aid to the WHO, in no small part because they believe the WHO was too supine, I guess, in dealing with China. And to be fair, that criticism has some validity to it, because the Chinese did in some ways keep the scope of the problem less than fully transparent until mid to late January. And that is definitely a thing. So and the other way in which you've seen a breakdown in cooperation has been the efforts to get PPE, you know, personal protective equipment, mm-hmm. or vital pharmaceuticals or what have you. It's not just at the international realm of every state for itself. It's a Hobbesian war of all against.
So there are ways that this is like and unlike a zombie pandemic. But what do you think might be useful lessons?
So there are a couple. The first is that you should see. States should learn that other states might actually have some decent ideas on this. And so you do want to see the spread of best practices as soon as possible. And this is actually something that all three of these paradigms would actually in some ways have a little bit in common in predicting that this might happen. So that's thing one. Thing two, and this is the way in which I really do think the coronavirus pandemic has deviated dramatically from sort of the traditional zombie canon, has actually been the degree of social solidarity you've seen, regardless of the country. So you know what they never show in the zombie movies? They never show people gathering on the rooftops or balconies at 7 p.m. to applaud healthcare workers or emergency workers. And it's been, I have to say, frankly, pretty heartwarming to see those kinds of videos going out. And the degree to which you've seen, you know, even at the local level, people looking out for neighbors or making sure that the people they know are safe and so forth. So in some ways, that's been the most heartwarming element. And it probably tilts a little more in the liberal theory than it does the realist theory. But it shows that actually, in response to crises, people are paying attention. And even in states like the United States, where there's relatively low trust of institutions, you have seen people, you know, actually, by and large, acting with a fair amount of common sense and, you know, engaging in social distancing and so on and so forth. And that's something that you never see in the zombie canon.
All right. I'm going to harsh our mellow because what I was thinking is sort of almost something that I would steal for my next zombie movie were I to make one, were, you know, our society to survive. Because there's something happening in this pandemic that at least I have not seen in the zombie canon, which is the ways that the pandemic has exacerbated inequalities. Because, you know, when you think about it, if I mean, so we are seeing, you know, worse health outcomes for poor people and for minorities. You're also seeing, this is something I would want to see in a zombie movie too. We are seeing how our definition of frontline worker has expanded.
That's correct.
To include, you know, grocery store clerks and school lunch chefs, I will call them, which I think similarly in a zombie pandemic, those same people would also be very important. The same kinds of essential workers would need to be on our front lines. And I would want to see that. I think that would be an interesting step for a zombie movie to take.
So there are a few zombie movies that I really do actually think already do address the sort of inequality questions you're talking about. One would be Romero's in Romero's canon. I mean, it's funny. I say that Romero actually argues like a realist, but definitely Dawn of the Dead is clearly an indictment of consumer capitalism.
Oh, yeah. Well,
because it takes place in a mall. But actually, it's Land of the Dead that does the sort of haves and haves nots. And that's it's interesting. That's the one zombie movie he made with sort of name actors. You know, Dennis Hopper's in it, Simon Baker's in it, John Leguizamo's in it. John Leguizamo's amazing in it, actually. But that movie actually posits the idea that there's this place called Fiddler's Green in Pittsburgh where the sort of hoi polloi, the upper class live. And then there's everyone else that basically acts like proletariats. The other movie where I can think the inequality thing really comes to the forefront is a movie I just watched this week, and I'm embarrassed to say, is Train to Busan. Which is an amazing zombie movie from South Korea, in which almost all of the action takes place on a single train from Seoul down to Busan. And that's also a movie where, you know, the protagonist is a fund manager. And there's a lot of commentary by one of the other passengers sort of, you know, who talks about him like he's, you know, this sort of elitist and so forth. And indeed, he really does act like a fund manager in the first third of the movie. And then over time, you know, acts in a more humane way is the way I would put it, I guess. So it's there, but you're right in that, you know, if we think about how the canon works, the idea that the most valuable workers are also the ones viewed at the lowest part of the social hierarchy, that's, I think, something new. So, you know, maybe what you need really is almost a neo-Marxist approach.
I was going to very tactfully refrain from discussing your analysis of Marxism and the zombie canon because I know you believe that Marxists would declare solidarity with the undead. And as kind of a DSA type myself, I want to argue about that. But maybe this is a good place for us to end because we are going to get more into domestic politics.
That's correct.
In our next episode, which we will still be discussing your textbook. But again, I hope everyone knows it's not school.
No.
We're not doing school. There will not be a test. There will be no math.
Oh, definitely no math.
Dan, thank you for coming on the show. Well, it's our show. Thank you for being here, because you're supposed to be here. But thanks for the book. It's awesome.
Thank you, Honoree. Thank you for having this idea in the first place, because it's been fun to revisit this. I kind of feel like Michael Corleone in The Godfather Part 3 about the zombie canon. Every time I think I'm out, the undead drag me back in.
All right. Well, stay safe, my friend.
You too. Take care.